Hey, and once again, it's that time.
Blog Talk Radio.
It's May the 18th, 2016. As I said, it's 8 p.m. on Wednesday. We're live at the Kate Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son and the co-host, and you are?
I'm Kate Thompson, and welcome everyone to Kate Thompson Live.
And we're going to be waiting just for Wayne Gilman. He'll be calling in our other co-host this evening, and you wanted to talk about our guest this evening, Mom.
Yes, I do. And we are going to be talking to, as a matter of fact, he is probably on the way to calling in right now. His name is Bernard Marsh, and the book that he had written that we referred to some time ago, Everything is Still in Effect, and this is the body of work that he wrote. And the name of the book is Great White Way, Great White Lies. And, of course, that pertains to Broadway. And we were talking about the fact that, there's still discrimination in the hiring of black actors and actresses on Broadway. And it is still, everything is still in place. And we want to find out if there's any movement in the positive direction. And I understand that Wayne Gilman has joined us. Wayne, are you there?
Yes, I am, Kay. Good evening. How you doing?
Okay, fine. And what about you?
Everything's okay. just listening in, anxious to hear Mr. Marsh.
Yeah. We want to find out exactly what's going on, if there's any change, in Broadway, because there's so many new things there. And we want to know what's happening. Is it still, they're still practicing discrimination in hiring for jobs? With the performers or what? I know there are more jobs supposedly available, so that's what we're going to be talking to Bernard about, and he's going to be calling in very shortly.
Right. Yeah, it seems like I see more of us, and forgive me because I'm fighting my allergies this time of the year. I just hope everything I say makes sense. But the thing is just that I see more people of color than I ever saw before on the tube, on stage, in film, but yet we still have the issues of discrimination. It's still a situation when it comes to the Academy Awards, like this past year, it was nothing but last couple of years, it was a whitewash. There are a lot of products out there that I'm certain that we produce and should be basically getting the same level of acknowledgement and support as some of the white films, And I can't say it's an issue of not getting financial support from those who would ordinarily support us, because we're the ones generally in the theaters. We're the ones, basically the minute there's an action film or something to that effect, we are always, our community, when I say we, are the ones basically going out in droves to support. So it's not
sure.
Even about that. It's just an issue of acknowledgement.
Well, I don't know. I think he's going to be on with us in just about 5 minutes or even less. I just want to know what is really happening with that, because of this discrimination factor, it is still in existence. And yet we have a number of new plays on. What's the name of the play that everybody's talking about right now? Is it Hamilton or Hamlet?
Hamilton. And
yeah,
that's that's extremely diverse,
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's refreshing. It's something that the average person who's a theater person would not expect on Broadway, and it's tastefully done. And the gentleman who's, can't think of his name off the top of my head, see his face. He's very gifted. He was able to put together a product there, and he knew he would click, and whatever he was producing would transcend generations. And that was the hook. It's probably one of the most difficult Broadway productions to get in to see because it's so much in demand. But the bottom line is that, we are capable of producing so many different plays like that, even from a black perspective, a third world perspective, And these are the things that we have to look at. There's so much richness, if you will, in our culture, but yet we still don't get the support in some areas that we need to get productions going. And then there are people out there, I feel, who are in a position to support. And for some reason, there's a reluctance to provide. I don't know what's behind that. You know, I can't think of many, you know, off the top of my head, because it's not something that I'm exposed to, let's say, like Mr. Marsh. I mean, I know a couple of years ago, when I say a couple, I would say maybe more than 10 years ago, my younger sister with a mutual friend of hers in the business wanted to bring the Frankie Lyman story to Broadway. And
yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the story still resonates with a lot of people of that generation and young people who would like to know who was this person. Even if they're just familiar with hearing his music, you know, it was a question of getting the support from that perspective. But the problem in the final analysis was getting funding. I didn't realize how expensive it was to get people on Broadway. And I know, not to put my sister's business out in the street, but they were able to get some money from Whoopi Goldberg to the tune of $250,000. But even that was not enough, no matter how good the cast was and the off-Broadway production. They still needed more money to really sustain itself. So it's a gamble, but again, I know everything is predicated on the almighty dollar. And I'm certain Eric would probably be a better person in terms of giving an analysis as to what it would cost. And even our guest, Mr. Marsh, you know, he would know more.
I was going to say, Broadway is a very expensive thing to do, to produce. Obviously, if you just look at the real estate alone of where the theaters are, that tells you that a pricey endeavor. And from what I understand, it is a very, very costly thing, and it's kind of hard to make back the money, you know. I mean, the cost per week is so much that usually a hit show is a hard thing to come by, you know. They really have to really do well. So I know that from what I've heard in my years in the business and hearing about plays, people trying to produce plays on Broadway, that is a very expensive endeavor. So, which might be part of the reason why a lot of times they recycle old plays that have been hits before.
Yeah.
However, usually those old storylines are not ones that are very diverse, to have a better term. So, it's a difficult thing, the theater, and you know. It's a great tourist thing. It's great artistically, but it's a very difficult commerce creating endeavor.
You know, what's going on now too. I find that there are more episodes on television. You know, dealing with, for instance, Black life. For instance, there's a number of episodes. This is what TV series. And different episodes on slavery. And this one I was talking about, Eric, you introduced me to, Underground was one of them. And then there's House of Cards. All black men. House of Lies. But even those things are, you know, very expensive. However, we are seeing it. As a matter of fact, I'm really surprised at the number of shows that have actors, African-American actors or black actors, brown actors, because those series, they seem to be presenting more. I know because it's probably cheaper to do rather than a Broadway play. But the point is also, you know, like, for instance, The Color Purple. I don't know how that made out financially, but it was on Broadway for a while. Is it still on, do you know, or what?
Yeah, it's still there. Right? Jennifer Hudson is starring in it.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that's The Color Purple, the musical. It was made into a musical, so that is also something. Things usually regarding African Americans, mostly you're going to find them to be musicals. In terms of TV and film, it's a totally different emphasis in the genre. because it, particularly in terms of TV shows right now, there is a resurgence in terms of some of the in terms of black TV series that are getting done. There's a resurgence of black TV series now with the success of Empire. People were talking about that a lot more black shows were being written and developed in Hollywood, and now we're seeing the fruition of that. As I said, as you said, Mom, we have this show called Underground, which is about slaves, runaway slaves, takes place during the Civil War, the slavery era. We have Empire, as we talked about. There are a number of Black-ish is another show. There's another show coming on, which kind of is a TV series called Uncle Buck, starring Michael Epps, which is based on the movie about an uncle comes to live with a family, and it's kind of wild. So there's a lot of shows out there now. You got the one on NBC that tries to be like Black-ish. I forget, the Carmichaels, which... So you have a number of shows, black-themed shows, and those are just the ones that I know about offhand. You talked about House of Lies, which is not a black show, but but it stars Don Cheadle and has a black character at the lead. So, we have a number of shows that have that feature or are about African-Americans that are pretty good. So, and, of course, you have the Scandal, which is...
The House of Lies show.
Well, that's reality. We'll separate reality from that. That's something totally different. You have Scandal, which is stars Kerry Washington, so they're a black lead of the show. So there's a lot of shows out there that are starring black people. We're not even going to talk about the reality shows because that kind of it's a totally different genre, and
yeah,
it kind of lends itself to negative images. So for that, there are a lot of shows now. Unfortunately, I don't know in terms of Broadway, if Broadway is reflecting that as well, this resurgence of black literature and black products being done. I know the Color Purple has been on Broadway for a minute. You have the success of Hamilton, which is a diverse interracial cast. But I don't know of another black show. I think Shuffle Along is back on Broadway, starring Audra McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
So, which she'll probably get nominated for a Tony. She always does. So you have a number of black shows out there that a few black plays, but they're being successful nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm just baffled by the amount of money it would cost just to have something sustain itself. I was just looking at that one particular instance regarding my family, and you look at $250,000 is a lot of money, but I guess for Broadway, it's just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of a lot. But before we get off into that, let's talk about the current issues. We just had a couple of primaries last night, and Bernie on the Democratic side, Sanders is still putting up a fight and going to take it all the way to the convention, I guess, in terms of getting the Democratic nomination. And, it's getting a little bit bitter out there. They just had the battle some of the people got kind of Trump-like at the Nevada primary last week when they were yelling at the people, the organizers and things like that. And it got a little kind of like a Trump rally in terms of the passions getting really hot. So I hope that the Democrats and the folks just kind of maintain their willingness not to be like the other side and have an ugly bring an ugly aspect to the Democratic primary. We also have Donald Trump obviously got the lead. He's going to be the Republican nominee, and it's just funny to watch all the Republicans go through all of these conniptions, trying to decide whether they want to support the guy, the ones that want to go against him, seeing if they have enough power to go against him, instead of a third-party run, and the ones who didn't really support him, want to support him, but they're finding a way that maybe we could win with him. The whole conniptions that these people are going through is really funny now that they're trying to wrap themselves around supporting Donald Trump. It really is to see themselves twist themselves in these kind of shape-shifting ways to try to make it look okay. They're all trying to find a way to make it look okay for them to come out now and now support Donald Trump, which is really hilarious. And, you know, he's got these
things going on. I happen to agree. I mean, the only thing that really bothered – go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, the only thing that really bothers me about this whole scenario now, it just looks like the race is going to be a lot closer than what we thought it would be. And God forbid if we have a situation where Trump emerges, you know, victorious. And, you know, I never thought this would be possible. I thought America would come to its senses. But there's a lot of latent support out there, even in our own community, that we're unaware of. And it just seems to be a situation where he's capitalizing on that. And we're not looking at the bigger picture at stake. And I wish in many instances, if Bernie Sanders is truly a Democrat, he could still forward his agenda without having to create this consternation that may cost Hillary in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, whether it costs Hillary or not, we might as well talk about it, folks. I don't know if you can hear. Was he there, Ma?
Yeah, he's waiting. You know, they told him that there was no show on tonight.
Whether it costs us the election or not, you know, I kind of just lost my train of thought. But it's going to come down harder on black people. I mean, it always does. Our unemployment rate is always twice as much as the national average. And that's the thing, you know, I think a lot of times the politicians, they have big egos. And I know that Bernie's got all the people and he's rallying in them and he's getting caught up in the moment. But it's like you said, I hope you don't. If you're willing to take this all the way, Bernie, you better win. That's my thinking. If you're willing to challenge, then you better win, because now you're putting, I believe, you're putting the needs of his own ego in place and ahead of the needs of the people. Whether we can really win, we need to win. You know
exactly.
And we don't need that to be put in jeopardy. We don't need 8 years of Obama to be followed up by 4 years or 8 years of Trump, because we know what they're going to do. They're going to dismantle everything. And as I said, the people who catch the most hell in all of these scenarios are our group.
Right.
We're the ones who are twice as much unemployment. We're the ones, our young kids getting killed. So when a guy comes out and he's all for that for the average person, and that's great, man, that's great. But you just better win, you know, because if you don't win, then, you know, we can't afford for him not to win.
Exactly.
So while he's taking his time or wanting stuff to go, he could potentially, like you said, Wayne, be putting everything in jeopardy. So I think that we have Bernard Marsh on the line, and I'm going to open up your mic here, Bernard. If you called, it was probably before we were able to set up the show. Bernard Marsh, welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How's things going?
We had a little glitch there, you know, but we're going to be taking care of that, you know, right after this show. But Bernard Marsh, you know, author of Great White Way, Great White Line. We had you on before. Fascinating book, absolutely fascinating, dealing with, you know, actors and actresses on Broadway. And you had alluded to the fact that there was a great white, you're talking about Broadway, but you have a great white life. Where did that title come from? I mean, how did all this happen, you know?
Well, it just came to my mind. I mean, I was talking about the great white way, and I just realized that most of the things they were telling us were lies. So I just put them together and came up with the title of the book.
And it's been very successful, I understand.
Yeah.
You really revealed a lot of facts. So that's why, you know, we're talking about it again, and probably again sometime soon.
Yeah, and I just revised it about a week ago. Well, I just had it published, the revised edition of it.
Really?
Which gives
wow.
Yeah, it gives a more personal account of my personal take on, you know, situations that, you know, we were facing at the time, which now are resurfacing again. Yeah.
Mr. Marsh, Wayne Gilman here. I want to say good evening. And I just wanted to find out, because Kay and I and Eric were talking earlier about the circumstances of what's going on in the industry. Do you think things are getting better now than they were, say, 30, 40 years ago?
You know what? It's cyclical. You know, whenever Broadway is doing bad, they, you know, institute bringing on more black productions. But it's never consistency. It will only be here until the producers refurnish their bank accounts, and then it'll go right back to what they've been doing. You know, because as you can see with the election, you see all the subliminal racism that's been, you know, backed up in these in folks for years, and then they have it, and now they have this, you know, Trump is the excuse for letting them express themselves, and that's what's going on Broadway. You know, I mean, they're only, you know, holding back because they can make something out of it. But as soon as they achieve what the financial success, they'll revert back to what they've been doing. And primarily it's because we are not producers. You know, you may have Oprah Winfrey and a few others who dilly-dally in the business, but they're not constant producers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be a producer, you have to have the mindset to be a gambler. You take three or four shows and you produce them, and maybe one will be a success. That is the one that makes you money.
Well, if you had to,
they
you
don't.
Know, if you had to look at the shows right now that are on Broadway that are mainly, you know, dealing with African Americans or, you know, non-white, what would be those shows? What are we talking about? For instance, there are people listening right now, who, you know, waiting for me to tell them, you know, about what's on Broadway. Well, I could say, look at the Times and look at the other papers and whatnot.
Well,
you know, magazines, but, you know, we can get that, you know, personal information by talking to us. You see, so what are the other the shows on Broadway that you recommend?
Well, I would recommend only to support them is Hamilton, Gloria Estefan's show, The Color Purple. But they're limited, you know, because these people will, that'll probably be the only show they ever do. Or it will never, just a, I was at my acceptance speech for the Achievement Award, the Adelco Achievement Award. And I told them, they constantly revise Fiddler on the Roof, Carousel, but they have not revised a black show that ever was a success on Broadway. No Bubble and Brown Sugar, no Sophisticated Ladies, no Arms to the Short, The Box with God. They refuse to revise these shows. And why? Because to the white producers, they have no appeal. Or is their way of saying you won't get a foothold on Broadway with these shows? Because many of them, of course, they are being produced by white producers. And They have it's a program, you know. They know what they're doing, and we, like I always say, you know, we can fight issues as often as we wish, but until we control or have some kind of control of the production department or the production head, this is going to be constant, you know, and people like Oprah Winfrey or Danny Glover, even Tyler Perry. I mean, he he produces all these shows, but they're non-union. And now the union has closed the door on him and said his shows, no equity performance can perform in any of his shows.
Wow.
Because he refuses to join the union or put them on a union contract.
And that's because of cost?
Well, you could only put your you could be a millionaire, but you can have 40 suits, but you can only put one pair of pants on at a time. How many pairs of pants do you need to say I'm satisfied? Tyler Perry is supposed to be a millionaire. How many more millions does he need to make to allow others to do the same thing? You know,
I hear what you're saying, and I'm a member of AFTRA, and you know, and I'm
not
saying the union is perfect either, but you know, you're right. It's about compensation and fairness.
And righteous compensation.
But wait a minute. What can the average person who is interested in New York City? What can we do about it? Is there anything that can be done?
Well, primarily, it's like I often say, in the early part of the film industry, when the production companies not only produced the films, but they also owned the theaters, and the antitrust laws were placed upon them, and they told them that, no, you have to dissolve one or the other. Either you're a film producer, but you cannot be a theater owner. The theaters have to be owned independently.
Mm.
On Broadway, it was like baseball. It was the exception. They allowed the producers to also own the theaters. So therefore, if they own the theaters, they own what goes in them.
Right.
And they make them available when they wish to make them available. If they wish to keep the black producers from infiltrating Broadway, they can't find a house to put their shows in because these producers own those houses.
And
they will rent them when they find it advantageous to themselves.
Yeah.
But Bernard, what were the problems that you were finding when you were the head of what were you the head of their what organization?
Art. Performance against racism on a theatrical stage.
Was that supported?
No. We had many people joined or signed up, but no one would stand up to fight because they were afraid of being blackballed.
Mm.
And because they were afraid of being blackballed, and there were no black producers producing shows, I mean, they wanted what they thought was work, but primarily out of, I would say, just take 100, maybe 10% or 10 of them make careers.
Mm.
You know, so therefore, you might as well have went out there and protested because you only hastened your limitations, but it was the reality that's all it would be until you created a place where black producers could come in. Once Ashley Springer died, that was the end of it.
You know, so in other words, you're really saying or suggesting, and what you're really not saying, is the black community and the Latino community, you know, those communities that don't have the representation on Broadway, you know, demonstrate, not necessarily demonstrate, but make their wishes known. In other words, write letters, you know, get on a bandwagon and, you know, just make sure that you let people know that you're going to be supporting these shows as long as they are good shows coming out. I mean, you know, people don't know that the black community is behind there. That's a whole lot of things, including into theater, obviously. So I think we have to, you know, talk more to the community so the community can support, you know, those plays, those musicals, those very delightful things on and off Broadway. The Color Purple is still running on the stand.
Well, you know what I say? My favorite motto is, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. You know?
Yeah.
And we are of that ilk. You know, again, like I say, people are afraid. It's like when I was out there protesting, I mean, I forfeited a career. And I said, well, that's what I will do. But there were other things I could do. I could write. I could teach, you know, until all of this, you know, healed over. And if I hadn't gotten in my accident, I would have probably still been able to pursue an active career on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
But because of my injuries, you know, that door closed. But we fail to look beyond the fact that you don't have to always be on stage to be a part of show business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a hard
thing. You could be
to get performers to get used to, Brother Nash, Brother Marsh, as you know, being a performer yourself, you know, that's a hard thing to get performers to accept, you know, people who want to.
No, it's hard for black performers to accept because that's all they are given. White performers
if you want to perform. In my experience, you want to perform. I've met a lot of people that have wanted to work, and they had a hard time. They had a hard time getting behind the camera. You know, that's why you have so many old actors that don't know when to get off the stage or so to speak, or get off the screen. You know, it's a hard thing, and at least in my experience, to get performers to try to be aware of that. And you're right, certain black performers, we need to be aware of how to produce and write and do those things as well.
Right, and learn how to negotiate. You know, Tyler Perry, just recently when they blackballed his productions, I wrote him a letter saying, look, if you need help trying to negotiate with Equity, we can find a contract that would be, you know, acceptable to you.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, what Equity gave you is a contract that they wanted you to have. But if you make the point and bargain with them, you can get the contract that is acceptable to you.
Right.
But he didn't want, I wouldn't say he, because I don't know what his internal mind was saying, but primarily it's you want all of the eggs in the basket. And you have to give up something in order to get something back.
Of course.
And a performer is entitled to royalties. They're entitled to sick pay. They're entitled to health care. They're entitled to unemployment benefits after they finish feeding your coffer. And how much do you want in your coffer?
Mm.
A lot.
To be before you are satisfied and being able to share with someone else and show someone else the process. Oprah Winfrey did it with Tyler Perry, and then Tyler Perry, I don't believe she. I would say to myself, I don't believe she knows what this man has done. He refuses to negotiate union-wise with any unions that are feeling even in film.
Oh yeah, he's notorious for the Writers Guild brought a. Had an issue with him because he wasn't paying the writers. I had a friend who was head writer. House of Pain and Meet the Browns, and he would have both shows being produced simultaneously. And what this writer friend of mine was telling me, is that you were getting paid for one, but you're working on two shows. So some of the writers took issue with Tyler.
All right.
Wow.
I mean, so like in teaching acting, I always tell students, you know what? It's very easy to do the bad things in acting, but it requires a lot of intelligence and work to learn the good aspects of acting.
Right.
You know. Many people go for the easy way. You know. No. In order to become a great actor, you have to you have to go some, you know, you have to give of your time. You have to go through these, be part of these readings. You have to be a part of Showcase Productions before you can qualify yourself as an actor. But many of you want to take the shortcut.
Yeah.
You know, and learn all of the bad habits of being an actor to get that little piece of the rock that you will only last you for a minute or two, opposed to having longevity as with Cecily Tyson.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, you know, we have our society nowadays, which is an immediate gratification society. It's interesting you say that, because everybody, now you got people who just want to be famous. I mean, if you look at Facebook, people are taking pictures of themselves. Just want you to check them out just because they're taking pictures. You know, some people don't even want to put the work in to be the actor anymore.
Right.
Some people don't even want to put the work in to be famous. They just want to take pictures of themselves.
Just look at the reality shows that they have. Love and Hip Hop, Love and Hip Hop Atlanta, Black Ink. Why would you, the lowest denomination of humanity is what they represent for people to emulate.
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people, you know, actors, we're acting. You know, when we create, you know, my mother and I were having a discussion, and I think my sister was in on it too. And I was saying, you know, reality shows, you know, the reason why these people drink and stuff, that creates drama. Everybody likes to watch drama. That's what makes good theater.
Drama is not life, and movies and drama.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes good theaters and movies and things like that is you have conflict. We know the basic, when we learn acting or drama 101, you have conflict within a story. And what's the obstacle that the character is coming up against and has to overcome? And that's the basis of what we do. However, I always tell people, we're not portraying ourselves. We're portraying characters.
No.
We're not putting our personal lives out there to be critiqued, and the drama and all the crazy stuff that goes along with our personal lives. That's the whole thing people don't understand. As actors, we're acting. We're not trying to be, heaven forbid, we don't want to put our families and our real lives out there. So it's like you said, some of these people go for the lowest common denominator, and they allow themselves to act in ways that probably would make their family and friends ashamed of them, all for that bottom, for that dollar that you mentioned a little while
ago.
And it really is unfortunate.
As Richard Pryor once said, is Richard Pryor, I don't know if it's Richard Pryor or Chris Rock, he's defined, says there's a difference between being rich and wealthy. Rich is one generation. Wealthy is over a period of generations. And most of us settle for being rich, which only means we're the only generation that's ever going to be rich.
Mm-hmm.
Your children and your siblings and your progeny, the money won't last.
Right. That's very true.
You know, because you're not educated, you're not, and like I said, the history of theater, people forget, the history of theater has always been to teach, one way or the other, going back to
right.
the Greeks.
Exactly.
They didn't perform just to be performing. They performed to tell a story about what was going on, what was currently going on. So the masses, even though they couldn't read, they could see and say,
right.
and relate to, oh, that's what's happening, you know, in the palace.
I have to agree with you. I mean, this transcends just the entertainment industry. I mean, it applies to, there's something in our DNA. I don't know if it has something to do with slavery, but you're absolutely right about the progeny having to go through the same problems that, you know, maybe their foreparents had gone through just to get to where they need to be. You know, there's never an easy or smooth transition, you know? And it's a lesson we need to learn.
Well, it's not in the DNA. I don't think it's in the DNA.
Right. I think it's one of the things of partly due to slavery that we want,
right.
we need that instant gratification. and we can't wait for it because they were never guaranteed that you would live long enough to enjoy it. Mm. And we've lost that understanding that, no, you do this, you build. You know, you build to, for it to go on for generations and generations. The Rockefellers built their foundation to continue beyond their life.
Exactly.
We have to maintain. We have to remember that, you know, and like Bernard said a little while ago about people being penalized when they stood up and spoke. That's been the experience of African Americans in this country from day one. We've been penalized in various areas, things that help to keep us from creating really black wealth. I mean, it's the fact that after the after World War One or World War Two. After World War One or World War Two, when a lot of GIs were coming back from the war, they had a, I mean, Dr. King. If you can YouTube this now, Dr. King breaks it down on a speech he was given that a lot of GIs were given loans to get houses. You know, that's how you had the great middle class. They were given loans to get houses and build these communities, the communities out there, Left Rack City, whatever those examples we used to see from those old films of the 50s, and a lot of the African Americans. We're not given these loans. We're discriminated against to give these loans. I mean, you could go back even further to the 40 acres and a mule that was promised. Can you imagine that if you had generations of black people having 40 acres in this country? I mean, look what they did to Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Tulsa riot. So, I mean, there's a systematic, there's something in place to keep us, they built a system in place to keep us from gaining wealth as a whole, as a group, as a people.
The only thing I just have to say to counter that is that there's some of us who have really arrived, that we are sitting on wealth, and yet there is not that follow-through. I mean, it may not apply to everybody. You know, I've seen things. I mean, I hate to go as far as saying, even within my own family on a smaller scale, politicians that I've known and worked for, people that your mother knew well, it dies with that generation. You know, no one is grooming and trying to promote and have that consistency that Mr. Marsh was just talking about.
These are individual scenarios, unfortunately, and unfortunately there's way too many of those stories like that. But I can point to stories. One that comes to mind right now is Kathy Hughes, the owner, CEO of TV1. And she's developing the whole empire with her son. Her son works with her very closely. So, you know, part of the thing is, and Bernard, you touched on it earlier, part of the thing, in my estimation, at least anyway, in terms of when you try to get people to stand up, it's like you're saying, when someone stands up, they're worried about getting blackballed. And, you know, when you get to that point, you know, it's hard to, you know, when you have a buyer's market, basically, you know, our business, Bernard, it's like, okay, if you can't do it, we'll get the next one. You know, the next dancer, the next actor right behind you that's willing to take your place and do what you're not willing to do. And are you willing to play this scene in derogatory manner as an African-American man, woman, whatever? But there is somebody that's willing to do that that maybe doesn't get the significance of how this image will be damaging. So and when you have a buyer's market like that, you know, the people that need the money, you know, the have-nots.
Yeah.
They got to get paid, so somebody's going to do it, unfortunately. And I don't think that's restricted to just our people. I think that's the plight of human beings, the haves and the have-nots.
But you see, I just watch it as when I go primarily to Manhattan, you see these vendors. They're out there every day selling in 0 degrees weather, selling their products, but they only do that for one generation. The next thing they buy a store. After they open a restaurant or they open a facility, we don't want to go through that process. We think we've passed that process, that level of process, and we don't want. I'm not to say we, and I'm making a blanket statement, but primarily. We are not informed that this is how you acquire wealth. They tell us all the time, no, it's not wealth. If you're making X amount of dollars, then you don't shop at A&S anymore. You don't shop at Macy's. You go to Prada. you spend your money at Prada, where Prada's in Italy. They will never bring that money back to you, to your community.
Right.
So we they use diversion against us, and we are very susceptible to diversion. Or they implement situations that are so appealing, like drugs and guns and killing and robbing, as an easy access to obtain immediate wealth or empowerment. But they don't say, well, you know what, you should go to the ballot box and make sure you vote every year. Bring up the issues, go to the meetings, go to the community board meetings, go to the city council meetings, and find out what is going on. So when you find out that in 20 years they're going to, that community that is in disrepair, they're going to go over there and they're going to buy up all the property there, and then they're going to build high rises in that community and run all of the lower rent payers out. You know, we don't encourage that.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage, no, go move to Long Island, or go move to Miami, buy a mansion, and before you know it, you're working to pay the taxes on a mansion that you don't even live in.
Yeah.
Sure.
You see. And then you have to revert back, come back to the ghetto with your hat in your hand, saying, "Can I come in here and get a room?" Hey,
well
you had it. You didn't want to be bothered with us,
right? And that's the thing that is that concept now. You know, a lot of these young kids now are like, yeah. I mean, there's a movement to buy in the hood, buy, you know, spend your money where you're from. Help to rejuvenate your neighborhood, your block, your community, as opposed to taking the money, moving out once you get successful, taking that wealth, taking that example of good living, that example of how to achieve out of the community where your neighbors and those other people can't see, and some of those good habits rub off on them. So there's a movement now, a lot of young folks, and I know in particular it's happening in New York, in the neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Harlem, that, no, we're going to stay here, and we're going to help turn our community around and build up our own and recycle that black dollar that you're talking about, Bernard. I got a question, though, for going in another direction for you. You were starting your career as a dancer, I believe. Is that correct, sir?
Yes.
You're a triple threat, obviously, but and this is, a lot of people don't know this. You know, when you're trained to work on the stage, you're trained to work. You're trained to act, be able to sing and dance, and rarely. You know, Bernard is a rare gem that you find, a triple threat person. All the rest of us, either one or two, maybe one thread, you know. But the difference is a different discipline is what I'm trying to get at on the stage than on film and TV.
Yeah.
Not to negate or discredit the discipline of film and TV, but you do get to do it over again. You know, right, Bernard, you know, when you're in that moment on stage, whatever has to be real life for that 2 hours got to be real life. So if something happens on stage, somebody has a malfunction with a wardrobe piece or a set piece, you better, if you're really good, make that part of the reality of the stage.
Right.
You know, and use that as theater stage business or theater life and create that into a reality.
Wow.
And that's when you really engage the audience and the people. I remember one time somebody told me about seeing Glenn Turman in a play down in Henry Street. I think it might have been you, Mom, and one of the actors came and he closed the door and a set piece came off, and it was a man and a woman, and they said something like, Glenn or the actor said, "Woman, I'm so in love with you, you got the walls falling down," or something like that. So
incorporate
exactly.
Improvisation,
and it helps, you know. So that's the difference of the discipline. But I happen to be watching a clip either of Cotton Club or The Wiz, and it was a real quick clip of the chorus spanning by as I was watching the movie, and I thought I saw a clip of you, Mr. Marsh, in one of those films. Would you correct me and let me know which film that was that I might have seen you in?
I was in both. I was in Cotton Club and Malcolm X.
And Cotton Club and it was
right.
Cotton,
Cotton Club,
Club in the
is the tip of me going on the staircase. That's just
right.
Is a shot, and then there's a shot of me in the Grand Central Station at the end doing the final dance number.
Right, but you also worked in the Cotton Club when there was a big chorus sequence, right, with Gregory,
right,
I think, or
right.
Right, I saw you in that, and
wow.
that was a great film, really great film, I thought. At least the parts that we got to see about the black life in Harlem. Can you just tell us how it was to work on that? Because that was really it ended up being a landmark film.
Sure.
And certainly portraying that side, you know, Gregory and his brother, they had a halfway decent storyline, at least a little bit. But how was it working
it
on that film?
It would have more depth had the producer, I forget his name now. He had a cosmetic line at one point. Came down and said because if the movie was running, if they wanted to tell the whole story, it would be a 3-hour movie.
Right.
He was limitedly funded. And he sent down a memorandum to the director, Francis Ford Coppola, and said, cut the black story and let's get to this white story, and that's
wow.
the picture.
Right, that's what I
because
heard, too.
There are a lot of segments featuring Gregory and what was the female lead? I forget her name.
Diane Lane. Oh, you talking about Vonette.
Not Diana Lane, the black girl.
Lynette
McKee. There were a lot more scenes that they did explaining their situation, why she
mm-hmm.
sort of turned over to being, to sort of passing subliminally for white, which was eliminated from the film. They showed you it, but they let you know the reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were much more scenes within the Cotton Club featuring the black performers.
Right.
And they cut all of it out.
Named the Cotton Club, you expect to see it be about the Cotton Club, and it's about, of course, one of them, as usual.
White folks.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's how we have to tell our story.
Even then, they knew that, it's not viable. You know, black, cut that. They don't even know about that.
Right.
They might get too uppity once they find out that, oh, that's what happened.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. In that era, in history, that Harlem Renaissance era, that Cotton Club era, is so rich with history from our people. I really would like to see a substantial story along those lines. I mean, it really is a very fertile time for us and for black people. That's when a lot of that self-production started happening a little bit that you're talking about, at least in terms of, you know, the shows, the cabaret shows, and having some of those little clubs uptown. I think that was really the heyday of that time.
Right. But, again, we allowed, once desegregation came in and we found out that we could work at the Flamingo and we could work at the Copacabana, they left Small's Paradise
right.
to go downtown.
Right.
And the people downtown said, oh, they're coming down here and they want this money, but you know how we're going to get that money back? Put them on drugs.
Mm.
And so no one accumulated any kind of wealth. The only people who, even the most noted of our performers, didn't accumulate wealth. One of the only ones that did it, and because his wife had the intelligence to know, was Louis Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He was one of the very few black performers of the time that didn't die poor.
Right, right. Yeah, he had a nice house over there in Queens. I remember when Louis Armstrong
Which
passed,
is now
right?
a museum.
Right. Mm-hmm. He lived over there in Queens.
You know,
yeah.
so, I'm sorry?
He lived over there in Queens, right?
Yeah,
Flushing. Astoria.
Astoria,
right.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you're talking,
but,
I, I, I'm reminded of Nat King Cole's story. I mean, it wasn't that he didn't die penniless and all that, but
No, he too was one of the more successful black performers, because he didn't, as far as I know, he never had a history of drugs.
Yeah, no, but I'm talking about what he went through in terms of being accepted when he had the, when they gave him his TV show, they tried to lighten him up with makeup. Even one of his white friends were like, look, we'll just talk about that. There's a great documentary on HBO Showtime about the struggles that Nat King Cole went through, even though that he was very loved and people loved his voice. They didn't want him to live in his neighborhood in Hancock Park, California, which is a very relatively wealthy neighborhood. They didn't want him living out there, and he just caught, you know, a lot of stuff. I mean, his show was boycotted in the southern parts of the country when it was on the
right.
air, and a lot of those things.
It was
things
only on the air for one season.
Right, right.
Is that right? One season.
Right.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of the performers of that day wanted to perform. A lot of the mainstream white performers wanted to be on there. You had Tony Bennett. You had a lot of mainstream white performers that wanted to do Nat King Cole's show. And this is a movie, and even a TV movie that's never been done. And it's the incredible story of Nat King Cole. And it's so indicative of the stories that you tell, that you're telling, Bernard, about, you know, even at his level of phenomenal success, what he still experienced, you know?
Right. And we don't really know, well, did he sell out or not?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because no one else preceded, you know, came after him.
Right.
Except
right.
Johnny Mathis, and Johnny Mathis totally appealed to white folks.
Yes, yes.
His whole, he was the successor to Nat King Cole as far as romantic voices were concerned, but
mm-hmm.
his music was directed to white people, and black people had to get used to that. You know,
right.
it was something they had to acquire.
Right. Johnny Mathis was like Charlie Pride to me, you know, the one, the
right.
black guy singing that different kind of genre music that kind of, you know, for a long time I didn't, it's like, exactly like you said, I didn't equate Johnny Mathis so much with the black culture as much as I equated with Nat King Cole, and that was just growing up as I did in the household, as I did in the society, as I did. You know,
right.
the value system was a reflection. I was a reflection of the value system of the society. So it's exactly as you say. You know, we're coming up on 2 minutes, and we've had this fascinating conversation with Bernard Marsh, give us a history about Broadway and the great white way of Broadway, great white way, great white lies. A lie, you can't live forever. That's the book, one of the books that you've written. And it really is enlightening.
It's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon, available on Amazon. Everyone should go out and pick it up because it's a great read, and you'll learn a lot about, you know, if you're a student of Broadway, if you're a student of African Americans in show business, this is a book that you want to talk about. And we want to thank you, Bernard, for coming up and having this conversation with us once again. And we're going to do it again in the future.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
All
you.
Right, we will talk to you soon. You take care.
All righty,
Wayne,
love.
Bye-bye. Wayne Gilman.
Thank you.
Mr. Newsman,
thank you.
Thanks for being on once again. This conversation went really quickly. It was so good.
Yeah.
We will talk to you next week. I want to get your opinion. We didn't get about what you're thinking about Mayor de Blasio and his troubles and Governor Cuomo. We could talk about that next week, Wayne.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Wayne Gilman. We'll see you again next week. My name is Eric Payne. This has been the Kate Thompson Live Show. You can listen to us every Wednesday live, 8 to 9 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/Kate Thompson Live. You are?
Kate Thompson, and I'm live.
All right. And not until next week, but you can also listen to the show archived whenever you want at blogtalkradio.com/Kate Thompson Live. You can listen to any show anytime you want, or you can wait till Wednesdays and listen to us live. Thanks for listening. We'll thank you once again. Thanks to Bernard Wash, and Wayne Gilman. We'll see you next week. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.